I'm Stargate Pioneer.
I'm Haley.
And I'm Lauren from Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D.
A podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts
at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Hello, and I'm Annika Wills, and I played Polly in Doctor Who in 1966, and you are listening to Gallifrey Public Radio.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten. Did you just say womp womp? And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I like it with the helmet on.
And Keir Hansen.
And that's why, to this day, I can't eat cotton candy.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 211 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where every once in a while we get an answer to our secret desire to know the daily goings-on of our alien foes when they're not invading our planet, and then we sort of wish we didn't find out. It's kind of like E.T. meets TMI. You know? I'm your host. My name is Keir Hansen, and joining me in the studios this evening is Haley Malley. Haley, how you doing tonight?
Pretty good. Not as good as some in this episode, I guess, but pretty good.
Some people did real well this episode. What are we tackling this week?
Well, this week we're going to put the needle back down on the Shadowkin record and pick up where April's difficulties left off, being a co-owner of a lonely heart, the fourth episode of Class in the freshman season. In a single episode, we're given estranged fathers staved off by scimitars, promises of emancipation from alien slavery, bloodthirsty cherry blossoms, weapons of mass destruction, and a heavy dollop of high school sex. It must be December, because it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
What more could you want stuffed in your stocking?
Whoa, yeah, phrasing.
We're bringing that back, right? Yeah, there's a ton going on in here. And I actually did not know going into this that this was going to be a two-parter. I didn't know that they were actually planning any two-parters in this season, but I'm kind of glad they did, because this is a story that had so much getting teed up in here that I didn't want them to rush to a conclusion. There was way too much going on. So before we dig into our storylines, what did you think of the episode in general?
I dug it. I really want to see the second half now.
And we're being good.
Yep.
We're being good. We're holding off. We're gonna watch this as we go through it. We're not gonna speed ahead, even though most of you have probably blasted on ahead of us anyway.
Well, yeah. Either you finished or you haven't watched any of it yet because you don't know how to.
Yeah. So it's either spoilers or this is stale news. So
yeah,
whichever you want. We're here to offend either way. Yeah, as I mentioned, there's a really lot going on here, but I guess if you want to kind of consider your primary plot lines, there's really two things going on here. There are these weird little flower blossoms that are blowing all over town, and only a handful of people apparently are recognizing the fact that if you come into skin contact with one of these things, it pricks the skin.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever that's worth, you know, okay, maybe it's just like a nettle or something and people don't really think much of it. But our other storyline that is not connected in any way we can see presently, is that we're, as Haley mentioned in the introduction here, we're back to April dealing with this shared heart with the Shadow King, and the issues that they're both apparently facing with that interconnectedness, which I found both disturbing and hilarious through this entire episode. I don't know. I love the fact that there was so much duplicity and simultaneous dialogue going on throughout. I thought that was, at times, I thought it was going to become problematic keeping track of, but Philippa Langdale, the director for this episode, did an exceptional job keeping it so that if you were sort of looking at either side of the looking glass, it was still wholly entertaining seeing how their behaviors and often their dialogue actually overlapped at the strangest moments. What did you take on when you got to the title kind of suggests we're dealing with it with a lonely heart here. Mm-hmm. They're doing a take on a classic Yes song. And thank you very much. We had somebody that chimed in on our comments on GallifreyPublicRadio.com to correct me on my dates. It was not an 80s tune. It was not technically a 90s tune. It happened back in the 80s, which I should have known because that was like sophomore year of high school for me. Yeah, dating myself, but whatever. Do the math. But who really is the lonely heart in this story?
I don't know. I mean, the obvious play is for April and maybe the Shadowkin as the co-owners of said lonely heart.
Right.
But then I by the end, neither of them are lonely, so...
It's true. Both of them got a little bit of a... I am going to refer to this as shadow cuddling. That's what this is. But then I also kind of thought a little bit about Charlie, because mm-hmm. we do get some progression. It's a secondary storyline here, but we get Charlie and Mateus having some conversations about the Cabinet of Souls and the discussion as to whether or not it's truly at its essence, is it a weapon or is it an object of remembrance or something else entirely? Is it a means to be able to restore the entire Rhodian race? Or is it something, completely outside, encompassing all of these things and more so? But every time he discusses it, and I'm really glad that they had this sort of moment of truth between the two of them, because that was definitely a relationship stepping stone for them. I thought everything was going to blow up when Mateus starts trying to sneak a peek into the cabinet. They handled that very carefully. Charlie didn't blow up on him, didn't accuse him of, snoopery or anything. But it was something that you could tell how much this continues to weigh on Charlie's heart, and being the last of his kind. We saw that from the premiere episode about what he's carrying.
Okay, so Quill and Charlie, they're from different cultures. Are they different species as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the Quill are their own species.
Okay.
Related, I think it's got to be very similar to what you had in early Skaro, when you had the sort of that civil divide. I don't know whether they were actually, evolutionary related, but I think they were sort of they were part of the heterogeny of their planet at the time, or at least at that time. And the Shadowkin sort of found them as a mutual means of being able to off them together.
Because I was kind of wondering, like, if Quill's people would be in that box as well. Like, if it's a biological function for them, like, they might not believe in whatever religious nature it has, but...
Yeah. No, I didn't get that impression.
Okay.
And I almost kind of got the feeling like Charlie had a cognizant connection with the souls in the cabinet, so that he knows in his heart of hearts that these are his Rhodian people, his ancestors, his family, his... everybody that he's lost, literally carrying a lot of baggage. So I kind of thought that to a certain degree there was a lot of play in that title, because we're dealing with this, and it also has to do with April in her relationship, or obviously in her situation with the Shadow King, but it's also April in dealing with the estrangement from her father and dealing with, the confrontations that she has with him when she's channeling the Shadow King and she's, lofting the swords above her head and she's tearing into him for everything that he did. I mean, we got the backstory about how horrific that trauma was, mm-hmm. And the fact that she calls it out and says that it made her stronger, she had to be. This was a galvanizing moment for April, because it now really brings everything to the forefront about her saying that, my kindness is not a source of weakness. My kindness is an active choice. And it's one of the things that Ram uses to try and talk her back down when she's about to just literally tear loose all over the garden. So I wanted to ask, because this was something that I that started to occur to me as just kind of clinging on there. I mean, I'm really invested in the casting that they've done for our four primary characters, or our four primary students, and obviously for Quill. But when they get into the ancillaries, I wonder if every once in a while they've got a little bit of a stumbling block. And it was April's parents that I'm not totally there yet. And especially when it comes to Dad, the sort of the frumpy Ted Danson looking. that's where my mind went when I saw him. But I know the character type is well presented, but I'm not really sure if I, between her and the mom, I'm not quite 100% in.
I think I buy the mom. She kind of reminds me of early Joyce on Buffy. I don't think I buy Dad. I kind of got like, he wasn't in a band when he was younger, but he hung out with a lot of the bands.
He was a roadie.
Yeah.
Definitely a roadie.
Yep.
With the hearing loss. I get, but then again, I mean, granted, since this is an entire spoiler-filled discussion we're having here, as we get to the closing moments when April decides to take some of the newfound powers and actually attempt to heal her mom, whether she knew what she was doing or she was just in the moment, very impulsive, pretty dangerous impulsive gesture there. But I liked the fact that they were able to convey a supporting character with disability on the show, and that was, and it was just accepted. You know, there was a backstory to it. It was accepted. It was part of it. I almost don't want them to walk that back.
I kind of wonder if it's going to be temporary.
Okay.
Like it's something, I hope so. It's something that happened because of her connection with the Shadowkin, and when that's severed, which I have to imagine that connection's going to be severed, then her actions will kind of be undone.
Right. And we get everything restored. Huh. I guess so. Yeah. I'm probably better with the mom, especially the hair-wring situation when she's sitting April and Ram down in front of her and having the shame discussion was absolutely classic. And so much credit given to the way April was being portrayed in that one.
That is exactly how you act while your mother's having that conversation with you.
Yeah. Sophie Hawkins was just slowly pulling every hair out of her head. Like, put my hair up because I got nothing else to do. Okay, put my hair down, shake my head. All right, wring my face. All right, rub my eyes. I've got nowhere to go. I can't escape from the situation.
And Ram's just like handling it. I was like, well, you got questions? I got answers.
It's just, I used condoms. I didn't want her to think less of you as his explanation. That's absolutely perfect. Going back for a second, or actually kind of leaping forward chronologically in the episode, if April's using that ability, if it just occurs to her because of the impulsivity of the moment, I guess she didn't have that thought when Ram had his legs severed. That would have been a good talent to know you possessed.
Well, I would assume that it's got to do with the whole anchor thing, strengthening the connection. So she probably couldn't have done that before this episode.
Okay.
And then it was the emotion of the scene with her mother and father that brought it up. And she was like, her. Mm. I believe it's the technical description of that.
Her. H-U-R-R-R-R. But I'm enjoying the fact that these realizations at those points where the connection is strong, and it allows them both to have a better visibility or a better sense of each other's location, mindset, passions,
showing the colors of the mate.
They were showing the colors of the mate. Oh, that poor Shadowkin. She was trying so hard, okay. And she was just.
So, do they not wear clothes? Is that just them naked?
I guess so. Well, that's normal. It's perfectly normal.
Yeah.
But, all right. So, by names here. So, the Shadow King as Coracinus, gets referenced maybe one or two times by name. And this weird relationship with Karis, who is the witch. I'm just going to call her Shadow Witch because it's the best way that I can go about it. I don't think I've laughed harder at one of these, because this is a pretty damn dark show, or has proven to be, or at least relatively intense, and it's unflinching. But these were laugh out loud, these were moments that Buffy couldn't always hit. Mm. As far as casting a humorous eye on the villains. You know, there's times when you would get some Spike stuff and you get some, you know, some of those.
I don't know. Glory was usually pretty funny.
Yeah. And yeah. Okay. But
that's the very peak of Buffy, and it took them till season 5 to get there.
Right. So this is the 4th episode of the first season, and they're cracking, you know, dialogue like this. You know, do you mind if we cuddle? I mean, really? I mean, and a quick cutaway. Don't even linger. Like, Joss Whedon would have kept the camera on her face to get an alien villain reaction to kind of thing. Ness doesn't even stay on it. Cut away. Let the audience react with it and keep the scenes hopping. I love that because it's like the decision not to wait for a laugh track. Mm-hmm. You know, so kudos to him on that one.
Actually, Joss would have gotten a commercial
right at that moment.
Yep.
Hit him with a ba-dum, psh, break for commercial and let everybody talk about how great that was. So in terms of some of the other material that all gets kind of churned up here, the governors. So we've got this plant now, Dorothea, who's our head teacher,
who has kind of a Missy Umbridge vibe.
Yes, but it's so toned down. I like the fact that it's distinctly different. You know, it's not as crazy. It's not as manipulative or evil. You can't really tell whether she's just there to maintain. She kind of is, because she's not wishing the students harm. She doesn't do a thing to them. In fact, she's, you're helping an ill student back home. Wonderful. Off you go. We'll see you back at school tomorrow.
And she's clearly kind of trying to deal with whatever bad situation is happening with the evil cherry blossoms of death.
Right. So they have, it's almost like a policing presence. I love the fact the discussion, they just quickly pass off, oh, yeah, robots are so expensive. Do you know what it takes to maintain these things? Yeah. So they're not trying to be overtly mysterious. It's just a matter of, if you don't ask, we're not going to divulge. So either someone's going to have to start really putting the questions to them in subsequent episodes, or it's just going to have to be accepted. Okay, they're not necessarily stepping in our way. In fact, they've given us a little bit of an assist on a few things, but we also know they're responsible for, you know, androids observing Miss Quill and so forth. And specifically with Quill, that there's this offer on the table to remove the brain bug.
Which is probably especially enticing at this moment, because Charlie has been so dickish this episode.
Yes. Yeah. His power plays, or his flaunting his authority kind of thing. And I thought that was a really poignant argument between he and Tanya. And Tanya doesn't back down.
She calls him out on it and does not back down.
Yeah. Yeah. I love her for that. And I hope that remains, because of the fact that she's supposed to be, at least within the casting, she's the youngest of all the students there.
I think she's supposed to be 14, they said.
Yeah. She's like 2 to 3 years younger than everybody else within that little circle. So you would think that she's the one who's just going to accept whatever she's told for inclusion. So that she can sort of act old beyond her years.
And especially the way he presented the argument, like, you know, don't question my culture.
Yeah, well, if your culture requires genocide, you know. So she's definitely showing that she's far more cognizant of what's being discussed than a lot of people, both her peers and her parents, are giving her credit for. And I think that's necessary. I think that really is going to become called into action in episodes to come. I did note that I put down a quick note for myself here that, you know, as we're talking about characters who were sort of in the periphery to a certain degree. Tanya was definitely, she had her power episode last week, so she kind of stepped back. They let her jets cool a little bit. In one of the early scenes, we get Ram and his dad again. Mm-hmm. I freaking love Ram's dad. I didn't think so. I was preparing for him to be a dick.
No, he's awesome.
But he is absolutely awesome. And I love the fact that he keeps stating that you know, if you want us there, we will be there for you. If you, yeah. And he's kind of implying, if you don't want us there, we're going to give you a sufficient amount of space, which was totally unexpected for him, because I thought he was going to be like this athlete's dad helicopter kind of figure. And totally proven wrong. Or at least that was just a quick... They put that as a surface representation in the first two episodes and then quickly peeled it off and said, ha-ha, appearances don't mean everything. Mm-hmm. There you go.
Also, his mom is still around somewhere.
Yeah.
But we haven't seen her.
Yeah, right.
She must work like the 3-10 shift or something. So...
Mm. Is she there or is she just in the picture and not, is this another single parent household? Did we get anything?
I don't know. I mean, because when he said we, I that kind of implies me and your mother as a team are there for you.
It could just be a strong parental presence without necessarily being, you know, the in-the-home nuclear family.
Right.
I mean, you see that represented every once in a while, which would be a nice juxtaposition against April's really jacked up nuclear family, which is so funny. You know, you get these moments where the dad is either, you know, like he's helping the mom up, you know, when she gets thrown to the ground after this whole traumatic experience, he's there holding her up. And as soon as she realizes he's back there, you know, she shrugs him off. It's that whole dynamic is sufficiently awkward. Mm. You know, I expect it to be really spiky and hot and cold and nobody really knows what to make of each other because of all the backstory.
Well, because he is ready to make amends and he's not taking into consideration that they are not ready for you to do that. You don't get to define the terms of the relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. What are you seeing as far as, so we've got all these loose threads. We've got the governors and Quill. We've got the deadly cherry blossoms, or at least the bloodthirsty cherry blossoms blowing all over the place that are apparently taking out squirrels and songbirds. You notice it's been really quiet in town? You've got April and Ram. April and Ram and their relationship, that's not really a problem. That's not a loose thread. But the April and her parents, both. You've got the fact that the two of them have now just dove through the rift, so they're now in shadow territory.
Mm-hmm. I was kind of surprised they introduced a new villain in this episode at the same time that they're bringing back the Shadowkin.
Right. So that's where I'm wondering. I mean, I'm glad that they took the time to spread this across two episodes to try and deal with it. Do they have to necessarily connect the two, or is this a matter of dividing the team?
I think
they have to work.
They want Ram and April to have this, you know, Shadowkin planet adventure story that they're going to have, and they need something for everybody else to be working on while they're doing that. So, because otherwise, you've got, and meanwhile, on Earth, the team is trying to get them back.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, yeah, they're going to try and do that, but they've got other things they got to deal with right now too.
Yeah. So it feels kind of Scooby-Doo in that regard. You know, Fred and Daphne are going to go off this way. Thelma and the two stoners are going to go off this way. Okay, I guess, yeah, I'm thoroughly pleased. I have a tendency to want to nitpick cliffhangers, but I've watched this episode now three times, and I keep picking up on things that I enjoy rather than things that I want to take apart. And I give a lot of credit to Langdale and her director's hand on this in keeping it clipped nice and tight and keeping scenes from feeling like they've run a little bit too long. It's constantly in motion. I mean, I don't think they're in a single scene for more than about, or in a single setting for more than about 3 minutes before we're bouncing elsewhere. And there's so much going on. And then again, Ness's writing is just stitched cloth tight. I'm continually impressed with his ability to call out, like you'll listen to Ram say something like, "Oh, the Shadow King's after your heart. That's one battle I know he's not going to win." And the moment he says it, you're like, that's the worst line ever. And then April says, that's the cheesiest damn line ever. It's the writer getting into the head of the audience saying, the moment that he pens it, he looks at that and says, the audience is going to say blah, 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 blah. So I'm going to have a character speak exactly what the audience was going to say. So it's like I'm getting in their heads. He does that constantly.
Another important thing this episode, we learned Quill's first name is Andrea.
Which doesn't suit her well. I wonder if she got stuck with that. That gives Ness an opportunity for one of the best little tips of the hat to Doctor Who ever. Charlie Smith.
Don't see Smith. A lot of Smiths.
It's like John. No one under the age of 35 is named John anymore. Oh, that's absolutely perfect. At that point, I kind of looked around to nobody else in the room. Did everybody else get that?
Where are the cats? I want to see if they got that reference. Yeah.
Wake up the cats. You got that, Thomas? Yeah, Thomas is here. He is not impressed. For those of you on the cast who have not met Thomas, this is Thomas.
Which is going to come across great in the audio podcast.
Yes, that's great. I'll do a screen capture of me holding the stupid cat up to the microphone. Okay. The dialogue in this one kills me. There's other stuff. There's Tanya's exchange in the hallway after Charlie says, "Well, I'd love to know from my other teachers how I'm doing to improve my academic performance." Thing walk away, and she gets to have that great exchange with Mateus about being an alien. And is he all human? You know, like.
Down there.
And this look kind of washes over Mateus' face.
She couldn't let it stop at, is he all human? She's got to make sure it's clear exactly what she's referring to.
She's 14. And that is the kind of thing, you know, I had this discussion with somebody the other day about the way kids at various ages censor or don't censor themselves. And they start to get into the middle school and early secondary school period where they'll say anything, half because they want to know and half because they want to see how everyone else is going to react. So, yeah, she'd absolutely just keep kind of poop, 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 poop. But Mateus, with that Polish demeanor, just kind of washes over. And she, yeah, no, never mind. I got to go. I got to bye. Oh, is that the class bell? I got to, yeah. So, anything else as far as dialogue that stood out in this one? It's Tanya. It's her. It's, you know, she gets the phone call from Ram. Everything's all horrible, and she's got to try to convey this to the rest of them. And it's a serious moment. I mean, she starts out, she's like, Ram said April's body's been taken over by the Shadowkin. And in the same breath, his voice sounded kind of funny. I think they had sex.
Ram and the Shadowkin?
Exactly. Classic. Gotta be a little more specific. Your pronouns are getting all over the place. I love this show.
I know. I want Tanya to have her own adventure episode. Like, yeah, she got her own episode, but it was super depressing. I want her to get to do some fun stuff and take the lead.
Yeah, yeah. Who was the annoying girl from Coal Hill that we hope? Courtney?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'd like to have an episode where Tanya just shuts down Courtney for all of her obnoxiousness. Okay. We didn't want to see her in class, but I would have a field day watching Tanya and Courtney go at it.
What were the other kids? Angie and Artie?
No. Were they Coal Hill students?
I don't know.
I thought they were like private school kids. Snotty little Maitlands.
Yeah, but after their tutor disappeared,
yeah,
their parents had enrolled to keep them somewhere.
Oh yeah, and get one more look at the dead teachers board,
which has added like six names since the show started.
I know they're gonna have to expand that.
They're gonna have to add a wing to the building to deal with that wall.
Yeah, the wall wraps around the corner. Yeah, I can't imagine what that's gotta be, and it's prominent. I mean, it's like right there in like the main lobby kind of thing. Walking, welcome to Coal Hill School. Here are all the faculty who have died.
Well, you know, at some schools, they've got like a plaque on the wall for, oh, this one teacher that died. But they couldn't do that. They couldn't give each teacher their own plaque.
This looks like the voting chart in the Second Continental Congress. We're like, okay, New York dead, Pennsylvania dead.
You know, dead. People walk in, oh, is that your list of donors or something? No, dead teachers.
Our donors board is that little piece of paper framed over there. It's about 8.5 by 11. Well, so well, that is it for the for episode 4, and we get our scenes from next week, and it looks like things just get continually bonkers and lots of set locations in the Shadow Palace. Gives our opportunity for the BBC crew to work with a lot of gray paint and orange LED lights. So, looking forward to it. I'm so curious to know how they're going to not only wrap these things up, how they're going to tie some of these things together, because some of these secondary plot lines are so disparate, or whether or not they even do, or whether these just become arcs to carry us through for a while.
Yeah, like at this point, I kind of think the Blossoms are just a separate thing that happens to be going down right now.
Yeah, yeah. Or is it like the scout tactic to kind of weaken the populace for something that's yet to come? And it's just the, and you always got to wonder, you know, if Earth has always been this magnet for problems, and Coal Hill being almost the epicenter of where a lot of this gets drawn, it's the bunghole of time, because we have to mention that every episode,
right?
Of course, because the show isn't clearly mentioning it anymore. That you would think that some of these infiltrations would be happening simultaneously. You know, in the grand scheme of things, if we've pissed off everybody, then there's got to be more than one consecutive, you know, attempt.
Right. Well, and right now the Shadowkin weren't able to directly get to us. April went to them.
Right. Okay. So our defensive forces, you know, meaning four students and a Quill, are weakened while we've got bloodthirsty little killer petals all over the place.
Also, if their scimitars can cut through space-time like that and open dimensions, why couldn't they just do that and come back?
I think they have to be sufficiently motivated. It has to be part the intent. And because she doesn't even know how to create them when she wants to. It's not an on-demand thing. It's something that's done in the heat of passion. So when her emotions run hot and she's sufficiently inspired to do so, she gets that moment of clarity that she's capable of that extra step. It's just like reaching into her mom's chest and doing shadow healing. She had no cognizance of that prior, but
yeah, you know. But I feel like the Shadowkin probably have a better grasp on what they can and can't do. I don't understand why they couldn't have come back more easily.
Well, I guess there is the possibility that that it was just a matter of being opportunistic. That April was the first one to recognize at that very moment that their connection, the strength of their connection waxes and wanes. Mm-hmm. So if she realizes at the moment that the connection is that strong and she is fully inclined to do so, she's capable of it.
Okay.
I mean, how did the Shadowkin get there before? I don't know. Does it really need that explanation? I'm not sure. But I'm sure all will be revealed next week. Or at least next week, the next time we discuss it, which is going to be
two weeks.
But anyway.
I mean, we're probably going to go watch it as soon as we finish doing this podcast.
I've got it queued up. It's just paused upstairs. I'm just waiting to start.
You got the timestamp at 000, so you don't have to wait for it to load up.
That's true. Well, 001, because I can never get the pause button to catch right. You know, that Apple TV remote's a little on a lag. All right, anyway, moving on.
We went to Elihu about a month ago now, and we've got another one of our great interviews from our library with the creators and cast of Doctor Who, and we are honored to sit and chat a bit with the story editor for the Sylvester McCoy years on the program and author of the biography Script Doctor, The Inside Story of Doctor Who, 1986-89, Mr. Andrew Cartmell.
So Friday morning, situated at Elihu, fourth iteration of this convention, and we are delighted to be sitting with editor and writer Andrew Cartmell. Good morning, Mr. Cartmell.
Good morning. I like the word iteration. Suggests we're in for classy chat.
We are indeed. Lots of polysyllabic words here. To jump right into things, you know, you've expressed on a number of different speaking engagements that while Davies and Moffat have had exceptional success in working with the franchise since 2005, you stated at times that you feel that in some sense the show may have lost some of the flexibility that it had when it was more of a one-off oriented story base. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, what I felt that I think they both did a great job, but the thing that Russell did was that he began to let serial elements creep back in. And what I always liked about it, and I think what you meant by the one-off thing, was that I'd never felt the Doctor was encumbered by his personal history.
Okay.
And I deliberately set about to get rid of the Time Lord thing, which was, I thought, the biggest anchor around the guy's neck. Because you suddenly, the initial conception of Doctor Who was that you had this stranger, and he, although nominally he had a granddaughter, you didn't know who he was, where he was from. It was a complete mystery, complete enigma. Right. And then as the decades roll on, you discover he's a Time Lord, he's this and that. And I felt that Russell did a similar thing to me in that he sort of wiped the Time Lord slate clean because he had the Time War. Mm-hmm. And he started off nice and fresh, but then he began to give the Doctor a new set of encumbrances in the sense that his instincts were always to write about characters and relationships. Mm-hmm. So suddenly you had this thing, what Terence Dix refers to as snogging in the TARDIS. You had this sexual tension between the Doctor and the companions. And I can understand why you would do that, but I also understand the problem with it, because you want the Doctor to be... He can have his companions, and they can have loyalty and affection for each other, but as soon as they start having, quote, relationships, unquote, you kind of clutter things up. And then when Stephen came along, and I thought Steve Moffat was very much one of the best Doctor Who writers, and he was a great choice for showrunner. And indeed, he did a fantastic job. But as his series went on, he began to give the Doctor, you know, like we have River Song, he's got a wife. And then worse than that, you began to see all the Time Lords were back. All the old canonical encumberments began to come back again. And I felt that the show had reached a point that had become so self-referential and so ensnared in its own mythos that you couldn't just sit down and watch it. I had a handyman coming. I've got too many books, so I've always getting bookshelves built. And this guy was around, and he said, "Oh, I saw Doctor Who the other night," and I just couldn't understand what was going on at all. And I felt, well, you see, that's the problem. You should have a show in which you can have running elements and you can refer to the canon, but it has to be in such a way that a casual viewer could pick up any single episode and watch it and enjoy it without having to have a briefing. Okay. So that was, I suppose, what you're referring to. And that's, I do feel that was the one way that the new Who, that's the one thing that they've got wrong.
Oh, well, dovetailing with that is actually the idea of a proactive versus a reactive Doctor. That at the beginning of the story, he's either coming into a situation that's already been established and he has to be the solution set, or one where he's just going about his way.
I know exactly what you mean, because in the Golden Age, he was mostly the reactive Doctor. Like they would land in some time or place, and then the TARDIS would be stolen, or they'd get captured. Mm-hmm. They're all, as you say, they're reactive. They're always reacting to things. And although I didn't realize it specifically at the time, somebody was talking to me up my ear of the show, and they said it was very unusual for the Doctor to be proactive, to have an agenda, to go place for a reason, and to have a mission. Right. And that's definitely something we did. Although I wasn't consciously thinking of it in those terms, that arose because I wanted the Doctor not to be passive, not to be a victim, to be pushing in his own direction. Okay. And it just arose from that. It made him a more interesting, more formidable character.
Was there any sort of a consensus effort, or was there a bit of pushback from Jonathan Turner? Or
no, John was generally very good about just letting me do all my crazy stuff. Okay. So it was just my take on what wasn't working before.
Okay.
Because I remember towards the end of Colin's era, and I thought Colin was a great Doctor who never got a fair shake from the stories, because he was very much, his character was often the fall guy and often the victim of situations. And then we end up with the Trial of the Time Lord, where, you know, he's in the dock. And I thought the exact opposite of that is the Doctor who's in control. We don't quite know what he's doing. He's got an edge of danger, and he's absolutely got that air of mystery. And when you start thinking in those terms, just because they were what turned me on, and also I felt they were in many ways truer to the original format of the show, the original concept of the show.
Right.
So that's what I was pursuing, because it had reached a point where it was fresh and different and a bit radical to do that, and I thought it was what it needed.
Now, as a very prolific writer, and I'll apply that label to you whether you choose to accept it or not, you obviously
prolific but very high quality.
Of course, sacrifice nothing. You obviously deal with the ebbs and flows of creativity when you're working. Now, knowing you have interests in things like yoga and culinary adventures in the kitchen and that sort of thing.
How did you know about the yoga?
What's that?
How did you know about... That's true, but how did you know about the yoga?
Oh, you discuss it regularly. We've seen...
Never shut up about the yoga, obviously. Yes.
Well, no. Well, you'll have to join Kat Smith when she does her morning yoga session on...
No, listen, seriously, I recommend it to anybody out there. Yoga is good for what ails you. You should look into it.
Well, that sort of goes along with the question is what are some of the methods that you use? Maybe that's one of them. Maybe escaping in the kitchen for a little while is another, to break down the creative barriers, the writer's blocks and things of that sort that come up at times.
I often say that I'd never had writer's block. I just had payment block. So because getting paid to do it is very difficult, but that's not entirely true. Sometimes I think the longer you put something off, the harder it gets to do. So I try and just get started on it. But I do have specific strategies for coming up with stories. In American television, you talk about breaking stories, which means to kind of come up with new concepts and fresh ideas. And the best way I've found to do that is when I'm doing something that's incredibly boring. Like if I try and go for a long swim every week, and God, it's boring. You know, you swim back and forth 50 lengths. So I've either got the choice of thinking how pissed off I am with some friend or member of my family, or working out stories. And so I found that when I'm swimming, it's really good for coming up with stories. And also when I do what I call hoovering the house, which you guys would call vacuuming the house, right? Again, it's so boring. Who wants to vacuum the house? But the only way I can get myself to do it is think, you know, if I come up with a few stories, I'll be able to sell them. While I'm hoovering, I'm actually making money. So those are the times, and it's incredibly useful. Also, you know, things like washing the dishes, any of those really boring activities, when your mind's sort of freewheeling, I find that that's the best time to come up with new story ideas. And even to elaborate existing story ideas, when you it's sort of like a recursive process or a fractal process, because first you have to come up with a story, you come up with a story, then you have to come up with the details of the story. It's the same kind of process all the way through, just thinking of fresh and interesting ways of doing things.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for spending a few moments of your time
with
us.
It's a real pleasure.
And hopefully we'll see you about on the floor over the course of the week.
Standing on my head on a yoga mat somewhere near you soon.
Cheers. Thank you so much. Right, a little bit of news this week. A very helpful little link to include in the show notes here for anybody who wants to get things all squared away and prepared. We are within a matter of weeks now before we get some new Who. I love saying that. Weeks away from new Doctor Who content in the form of the return of Dr. Mysterio. And thanks to the good folks over at the Radio Times, they put a nice little collection together. Just in the last few days, we got in a couple of new promo images to go along with some of the great trailers that we've received over the last few weeks. So they keep the running tally of all the news that we need to know about what to expect. Spoilers with or spoilers without, you can choose how you want to look over the information. And technically, just the one primary takeaway is that within the UK proper on BBC One on Christmas Day, the special will air at 5:45 in the evening. Now, I've checked as of our recording date, BBC America has not announced what the stateside broadcast space for those of us who are watching things on the Canadian broadcast. They have not announced their time for broadcast that day. I doubt, though, that, you know, do the math on it. If it's, you know, 5:45 p.m. In the UK, that would be 12:45 p.m. early afternoon Eastern here in North America.
Even earlier if you go to the West Coast.
Correct. So I highly doubt that it will be live simulcast. They will probably bump it into early evening to be something similar to a just around dinner time. Everyone knows you eat your holiday dinner at, you know, some ungodly hour, like 2 o'clock, you're having dinner at 2 o'clock in the afternoon kind of thing, so that you can sit around the house and clutch your stomach and groan for the rest of the day, or hide behind the couch, as you are wont to do. So in this case,
well, you know, they might just hold it off and air it right before the Doctor Who premiere for American audiences. Just have like a big evening of, you know, Doctor Who Christmas special, Doctor Who premiere class.
We decided it's Christmas in April, kids. We're going to make everybody wait just a little bit longer.
Yeah, but we've got this new show we decided everybody wanted to watch on Christmas Day instead.
Right, yeah. So, and then linking to that, obviously, is a great article or an interview, actually, that Wales Online was able to conduct with Peter Capaldi over this past week. The primary gist of the article is really just to discuss the nature of Christmas specials and why they have their own particular charm, why they tend to be a little bit on the campy side, or why they, you know, why they don't always connect to the storyline proper. And of course, as always, being the consummate fan that he is, Capaldi does a great job of expressing his justification for that sort of lighthearted adventure. You know, you're reaching out to a slightly different audience during that period, and you want it to be something that you can enjoy for its own merits, even if you don't by some strange reason know what this 53-year-old program is really all about. But the little addendum to this, and what sort of worked its way into the title for the article, is the fact that they press him a little bit on Series 11. And he's, in defiance of what the Mirror has been seeding as far as rumors out there, his word, and he's always been very good about towing the company line on what he can and can't say. He's been very, very good about it. I think out of respect for the legacy of the program and his respect for Stephen Moffat and company, is that, and I'll quote, "I've been asked to stay on, and I haven't made my mind up about that yet, mainly because I don't want to have to make that decision," which, knowing him, makes absolute sense. I mean, this is something he's waited for literally his entire acting career, longer than his acting career. He's wanted this, and now he has it, and he needs to, within his own heart of hearts, make a decision as to whether or not it's something that he wants or he feels is best for this program that he loves just as much as we do, if not more so. I can't imagine what that kind of decision process has to be.
I do have a hard time believing that that decision hasn't been made at this point, though, because they've already filmed, what, half the episodes? One would assume they're all written. So if he were planning on leaving in the finale of this series, I would think that decision would already be made. And I guess the question would be if maybe he's going to leave in a special after this series.
I'm willing to throw a monkey wrench into that, because we know how much of a writing procrastinator Moffat is. And if he is penning the last two episodes to be completed in the last production block, I will bet that he has not finished them yet. If he has, it's something, maybe he hasn't divulged it to the, you know, the first cut of the blue copies haven't made it out to the cast and crew yet. Because think back when he was writing Day of the Doctor, it was like weeks prior to principal production and he was still writing it, because he didn't know at that time who he was going to have in the cast. So those kinds of weird last minute decisions, whether they were in his control or out of his control, in that case they weren't. And if this is the case, if there's some validity to what Capaldi is saying, that he hasn't made his mind up yet, that's got Moffat waiting at the keyboard to decide. You know, and maybe it's something where PCAP has to go and have a couple of, you know, dinner and drinks with Chris Chibnall and really have a heart to heart and kind of think about, you know, if I stay on, is it going to be, you know, would it be in the best interest to stay on for half a season so that you've got a chance to do a mid-season regeneration? And what would that be like? And, you know,
I would love if they were to, you know, replace him sometime in the middle of a season. Like, we know there's going to be a replacement because you can't keep that under wraps, but to maybe not know exactly which episode it was going to happen in. Mm. So you're just like on the edge of your seat with every episode.
Yeah. The viewership would definitely spike if it's a matter of, is it this one? Is it this one? Is it this one? But they would, in order to do that, they would have to have so closed of a set, because the screening reports and the filming reports that are out there.
Well, you just have the new guy hang out on set every episode.
So they'd have to make the announcement of who the next Doctor's going to be and then have him just hanging around the trailers. Yep. Or just have a bunch of red herrings hanging around the trailers. There's Rupert Everett. There's blah, blah, blah. There's da, 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 da. There's so-and-so and so. Yeah. Oh, that'd be hilarious.
Everybody's panties would be in such a bunch.
That expression skeevy. Well, yeah. So, yeah, I think I'm in the same camp, because that would then mean that we'd get through an entire season with Bill, hopefully. Maybe maybe the rumor mill that was going around about everybody clearing house, everybody. Every time I say that word, I got to channel Samuel L. Jackson. Everybody would leave. Instead of them all leaving with Moffat, maybe it's just Pearl Mackey, which, again, we haven't even got a chance to really enjoy her work yet, so I don't want to see her out the door. But if that's the case, then it's a companion change at the end. Keep your doctor on. Change your doctor mid-season. Oh, it just gets really convoluted. Begin dreamcasting. Just go ahead. Didn't put this in the show notes, but for those of you who want to head over to regenerationwho.com, you will see within the next couple of weeks, they will be announcing some of the panels that are going to be included for March. Whenever that convention returns to Baltimore in early 2017, we will be there again. We've got four panels on the roster, one of which will be dreamcasting. We'll be discussing not only hypotheses for future casting, but also the ideas of things like, oh, what if you did U.S. casting? What if you did alternate gender casting? And so forth and so forth. So it just becomes a big, loud, rather argumentative free-for-all among other panels that we'll be having over the course of the weekend. So please join us at Regeneration Who. If you haven't been there before, it's a load of fun. Oni and James put on a fantastic con, and we're loving it already.
Yeah. And just to be clear, by us, Kier means him.
No, I will have our B team.
Okay.
Raimani will be with us. She will be there for our technical support,
right,
as always.
So he'll have an entourage, but as far as on-air talent,
they are card-carrying. They'll have media badges, darn it. So, but when we do convene for next week's GPR, we will be returning to our classic rewatch in Technicolor.
What?
Yeah, Doctor Who in color, as we venture into the Jon Pertwee era with none other than Spearhead from Space. So grab all the plastic wrap you got in your house and prepare for some Auton action, because we're getting Kung Fu style. There will be shower caps. there will be wheelchair races. There will be just all kinds of goodness. Haley has not seen this yet, have you?
I don't think so.
Did you? Okay.
I've seen one Pertwee episode, and it was the Autons. So no, I don't think I've seen this.
I think you saw the Terror of the Autons.
Yes, I think that is what I saw.
Actually follows this. So this is the one that teases it up. So this is Pertwee stumbling out of the TARDIS for the first time after being exiled on Earth, and Liz frackin' Shaw. That's all I got to say. We'll talk about it more next week. But until then, this has been episode 211 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Kier saying, do you remember Jay? He was that Texan who used to be on this podcast.
Ooh.
Yeah. I'll pour a 40 out in the curb for Jay.
And this is Haley saying, who?
We'll see you next week, y'all.
Bye.
I'm Ozzy.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.gungeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2016.
Well, we went to L.I. Who a month ago.
Why don't
now.
You start that one over again?
All right. Hugh?
Hugh.